Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, and Jacob Tender is joining us today to talk about the Dead Zone novel from 1979. Jacob, how are you doing today?
Good, but is that the book we were supposed to read?
Yes.
Oh, whoops. No, just kidding. Dead Zone. It's good fun. It's a good book.
Yeah, definitely. It's one that I can't remember exactly when I read it, but it was within the last year or so when I started going back through King's work chronologically. And then I had the idea for this podcast and I was like, oh, okay. Well, thankfully I only read, you know, X amount of books here before starting it. And I wasn't like halfway through the bibliography or anything like that.
Yeah. Oh, so the podcast is catching up to you.
Yes, pretty much.
Oh, interesting. Okay. That's interesting. Cool. I didn't know that. I thought you were just like starting, like you wanted to read through the King stuff. So you started the podcast to keep yourself honest or something, but that's cool. I'm glad that, you know, it's based on something you're already doing. That's kind of neat.
Yeah. At this point, I'm only a few books ahead right now of schedule. So, you know, we're doing the Dead Zone today and I'm reading the first Dark Tower book, The Gunslinger. So that is, let's see, it's a 1982 book. So I'm not too terribly far ahead, but I figure the further ahead I can stay, the easier it will be for guests to keep up with the show as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So, in the case of this book, when you read this one a couple months ago or whenever, was that the first time that you had read this book?
Yes, and I am reading a lot of this stuff for the first time. I had really only read a handful of his books, I want to say, before deciding to go back and go through chronologically, just because I knew how connected his universe can get. And if you don't know that at the start, like I did not know that, it sort of just makes you miss a lot of these cool little tidbits that he puts in. So I was like, all right, let me go back, start with Carrie. I skipped the ones I had already read. You know, I had read The Shining and a few other things, but otherwise it's a lot of this for the first time, which is making it a little more fun too, because I don't have to reread a ton of stuff that I've already read.
Yeah, it would be probably a lot harder if, you know, you'd read most of his work.
Yeah.
In middle school and then decided to start this podcast now post-college. That would be a lot rougher. But that was kind of the case for me on this particular book, because this is the only Stephen King book I had ever read.
Okay.
And it's still the only Stephen King book I've ever read. But I read this. I was trying to think of when I actually did read this. I own a physical copy of this book somewhere. I think it's still packed from when we moved. But
okay,
I'm pretty sure I read this in like seventh or eighth grade.
A little early for Stephen King, maybe.
Maybe. No, well, I don't know. I was reading some fairly mature stuff when I was younger. But yeah, I think that's when I read this book. And it's been a really weird experience going back through it, because I don't remember the book beyond the first chapter. Like, I remember the first chapter very clearly. And then I remember, like, I'd say what's probably the height of the book. I remember, like, the very end of the hunt for the killer. Like, I remember that, but apart from that, I remember 0% of this book. And it's been really strange and enjoyable, because I have this like anticipation that's like building up from within me. It's like something I almost recognize and like I can almost anticipate, but I have no idea what's going to happen. So it's given me like an extra level of like, wait, am I like leading up to something that I'm going to like remember? Is it all going to come flooding back? And then it doesn't, but it's still like really crazy and, you know, and like entertaining. It's been kind of cool.
My first experience with this story was actually watching the Anthony Michael Hall TV show, which, as you know, I believe it's quite a few seasons. It's probably like 5-ish seasons, somewhere around there. I don't have exact numbers on all of his TV series memorized, because there have been numerous ones, but I remember watching that show. I, like you though, I don't really remember the details. I sort of just remember that he was the star of it, and it was not that he could necessarily see dead people, but there were just a lot of dead people and weird things happening in general, and that's kind of the gist I had going into this book. So I was pleasantly surprised by how little that TV show gave away, because I didn't remember much of it.
I know nothing about that TV show except that Jeff Buckley's New Year's Prayer is the opening theme song. That's all I know. But I haven't watched it, nor the movie.
I would not have remembered that.
Because they made a movie out of this book too, didn't they?
Yes, there's a movie adaptation in 1989, or not 89, 1983. There we go.
It was a Cronenberg movie. David Cronenberg made that movie, and Christopher Walken was the lead. That's gotta be interesting.
It was a pretty big one. I have not seen that yet, though. So, you know, I would venture to say I have seen a lot more of the movies and TV shows than I have read the books. Maybe not at this point now, but I was more familiar with those going back and going through chronologically. You know, I'd watch things like Kubrick's Shining, and I rewatched that just because any excuse to watch that is fine by me.
Yeah, I've seen quite a few of his movies over the years too. There's so many. It's insane. I'd reckon at least 50% of his written work has been adapted in some way, right? Probably more than that. I'd probably closer to 80. It's insane the amount of adaptations that come out of his stuff.
Yeah, plus it helps that he does a lot of short stories and novellas too, because then you get these collected works and you can have, you know, 10 adaptations out of them.
I should get into more. I like that you made me... Well, okay. Look, I need to admit something off the top here. I was really looking forward to this because I thought over the past couple months, I've been thinking I really want to read more, because as a kid, I was a voracious reader. It's really all I did. Like I wasn't particularly athletic. I was involved in some activities, but I spent a lot of time reading, I'd say up through eighth grade. And that's the year I moved. And so when I moved, like my priorities changed, and it was basically like, okay, you need to make some new friends because you're about to go into high school. So, you know, there's like other things that came into play, and it like took me away from reading, and I never really came back to it. And over the years, it just tapered off and I just stopped. So on this thing, I'm like, all right, finally, I know that I've got a lot going on. It's going to be hard, but I'm going to have to read this book because I'm doing this podcast with Deanna. I didn't read the book. I had to get the audiobook because the only free time that I have is when I'm driving to class.
Yeah, that's hard. You definitely don't want to read and drive at the same time.
Definitely not. So I had to get the audiobook, and there's only one audiobook available, like one particular version of this book in audio format. And it was read by James Franco.
That's weird.
It is weird. It's not too weird because, you know, James Franco, like the running joke is that he does everything. Like,
yeah,
I have a million jobs. I think that was like an SNL skit of his or something. But it was a little distracting for a while. Like for the first couple chapters, it was really distracting. And then I did fall into it. But then there was one character that he did. And he did some voices, very light voice work. Nothing like, you know, too crazy. Not even like Jim Dale level Harry Potter voices, just very like subtle changes, so you kind of knew who was speaking at any given time. But he did a very different voice for Dr. Wyzak.
Okay.
And Dr. Wyzak, I think is he Polish or something? He's like European. I can't remember.
I don't remember exactly.
Right. But you know, he gave him some sort of, you know, European affectation that sounded exactly like his accent for Tommy Wiseau in The Disaster Artist, and it completely pulled me out of the book. It's the worst. I'll have to send you a clip so you can understand. It's just so distracting because it just sounds like Tommy Wiseau talking to Johnny in his hospital bed, and I wish there was another option, but it's all I had.
Yeah, it's hard too, because obviously when these books came out, audiobooks weren't quite a thing. You know, you have the audiobooks that come on CDs still at the libraries and everything like that, but then you have, you know, Overdrive and things like that that kind of modernized the library system, thankfully. Yeah. But yeah, I have a very old copy of this. Technically, my mom has a very old copy of this because she was buying them all when they were first coming out in like the mass market paperback size. And I apologize to everyone who has heard me say this like 10 times by now or whatever it's been. But, you know, so I have these older copies, and you can kind of just see the age on them from the covers. The covers aren't modernized like they do when they re-release the books and everything like that. So it's kind of been cool going back and just seeing what these books actually looked like in, you know, the 70s and 80s eras.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I have a first pressing, but it's probably pretty close. It's the one with the Stephen King or red letters with the big... big dead zone in gold up top.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I love
that's
that.
That's the one cover on the Wikipedia page.
Yeah,
so why don't we go ahead and jump on into the plot? We started with a little bit of a tangent here, but that's fine. It was still related, but the main character you have in this is John Smith. Not a very creative name, but that's okay. We'll let it pass.
Works to his favor at the end of the book, though.
Yeah, yeah. And he ends up being in a coma. So you have all of these sort of missing years where he just was in the hospital, and then he wakes up and becomes a high school teacher in Eastern Maine by 1970. So while the story doesn't start in the 70s, it sort of starts catching up to present day for when he's writing it. And I think, you know, he spends just enough time setting up the backstory. And pacing is something that I've been talking about a lot with these books, because in his early works, the books are fairly reasonable in length, I would say. You know, this one, the first edition, was 428 pages for the hardcover. I don't recall what the paperback copy I have was, but, you know, then you start to get into these much longer novels. I would say The Stand is his biggest early novel, and then the rest are sort of, you know, somewhat normal book length. And he just does so much character work that the plot of this one really gives him the time he needs to focus on that, because you only have a few main characters, really.
Yeah, it's not like a huge cast, and, you know, some people come and go, but it's primarily about the one character. On this book, though, it's like the structure of it is very interesting.
Yeah.
It's like the way that the plot plays out, you know, Stephen King is not the only one to do this, but early in the book, there will be short sections where you're getting like a little tease of things that are going to pop back into the story later. You know, places far away from Johnny with other characters that are seemingly completely unrelated, but eventually they're the reason for these early chapters kind of introducing you to these other strange characters that's going to make itself known. But these two kind of plot points, you know, they seemed linked in my interpretation while I was reading this book. I thought that every time he was cutting away to these other sections, when he was cutting away to, you know, this traveling salesman or, you know, this killer, I was thinking, like, this is one plot point. I was thinking that this was one thing. And we ended up learning later that that's not exactly true. The first one regarding the killer is tied up, though, by the end of the second third. Like, it's completely wrapped up, which leaves, like, a ton of pages left over to go through the rest of, you know, the story with the politician. And I mean, it's just a weird format, because, like, once you get to the killer, which you think in most mystery novels, when the killer is caught, you're like, okay, that's the end of the book. Or if there's anything remaining, you know, there's not much. It's tying up some loose ends. But when you get to that point, for me, it was like, okay, well, if the killer was caught so quickly, what could possibly be next? Like, what stakes are higher than that? Which was cool. It was interesting, and it made for a different read than most stereotypically, you know, mysterious novels of this sort, I guess.
I do like that you don't really get the full story right off the bat either, because you can sort of piece things together, or at least think you're piecing things together as you go through the book. And obviously bringing in the supernatural element is something that changes Johnny's life, and it changes sort of the book too, because you have this prologue and you have him in a coma and everything, and then when he comes out, he doesn't have his powers at full force right away. It's something that takes time to develop, and then people start learning about it, and he sort of becomes this media figure, and he does not want the attention at all. And I think it's a very interesting take on just how much the media can prod when people don't want them to. And obviously that's something that's still relevant today, because it's not like he asked for this power. And I would venture to say that most characters in Stephen King's novels who have powers did not ask for them, didn't really want them. And then you have some who know exactly how they want to use them. So you have a wide variety of characters. And here, you know, Johnny is just like, can you please leave me alone?
Do you know, what was your interpretation of his powers? When you read the book, you meet his mother, and his mother is sort of a religious fanatic, and she believes that, you know, God gave Johnny these powers, and or at least that's his interpretation of what she would have thought, because she dies fairly early on after his powers are revealed to the world. But what is your interpretation? Do you think that he was born with these powers, or they were triggered by, you know, these traumas that he had? First, that fall on the ice when he was a kid, and then later with the car crash.
I think there's something that always existed, but they were dormant for a while. And he just went through, like you said, these traumatic events, and that sort of brought it to the forefront. And that's not uncommon in things like diseases that we see. You know, someone could be born with a disease, but it doesn't show until later in life. So it felt more like that sort of thing to me.
But do you think that, you know, the intention when King was writing this was that there was sort of some like divinity involved, like he was given these powers at birth, or given these powers as a result of the accident, or the accident, you know, would trigger these dormant abilities as a result of divine intervention? Like, do you think any of that came into play, or was the character of Johnny's mother just sort of like a twist that would perhaps complicate Johnny's own view of his powers?
I definitely think that the mom had her own thoughts on how he got his powers, and she was sort of just dead set in believing what she believed in, to where she wouldn't accept any other sort of explanation. But I do still think it was more the trauma that brought this out, and, you know, why he was born with it, that's another thing. And I honestly could not say, but it, you know, with Stephen King novels, it's hard because he makes his characters realistic, but then gives him these abilities, sort of like comic book characters, where you're like, okay, you know, this isn't going to happen to anyone. You know, no one's going to be Carrie, and no one's going to take down an entire gym full of people in one go, sort of thing. Not in that way, at least. And with Johnny here, you have that same sort of thing. He is getting a feel for what he can do. And the fact that he was in a coma, what was it, twice? You know, he was in a coma for 5 years or 4.5 years after a car accident, but he was knocked unconscious while he was ice skating. So, you know, that's a big deal, especially to the brain. And that is explained a little by them calling it a dead zone within his brain. Mm-hmm. That is sort of triggering his powers and everything like that. So I think the idea was to make it more neurological, but the mom just wanted to believe what she believed.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I haven't read enough of Stephen King's works to really understand. Like, I know that, you know, kids or young people with powers is sort of a theme.
Yeah.
Within his books, but I'd be interested to read takes on like where those powers are supposed to have come from. I think he's probably ambiguous enough in his text for a reason, so, you know, so he doesn't have to come out and say like these were given to him by God or whatever. But I think that there's an interesting angle there, and I wonder what that's all about.
He probably likes leaving that mystery open to interpretation too, because he is someone that has always been very friendly to people adapting his works. You know, I don't know if you know about the Dollar Babies, but he will basically let film students buy the rights to any of his books for a dollar so they can adapt them for student films and everything like that, which is why we have 10 Children of the Corn movies, which is probably 10 too many, but that's besides the point. And it's just one of those things where I think he's always been very set in what he wants to accomplish with his work. And I know he doesn't like the Kubrick adaptation of The Shining because of how much it changes, but there are certain things where I think they're a little more open to interpretation, and that's what makes talking about these books so interesting, because it seems like a lot of people will take these open-ended ideas that he sort of just plants in the books and go in very different directions with them.
Yeah, I mean, Carrie was very similar to this. It had some similarities to the, I wouldn't say like the whole story is very similar,
right?
But towards the end, like, there are a lot of similarities. In fact, I believe this is maybe one of his first, because this is within like his first like 5 published works, right? This is one of his really early ones.
It's his 7th book, but it's the 5th under the Stephen King name, because he was also writing as Richard Bachman.
Right,
so yeah. It's one of those things where his bibliography is kind of hard to nail down exactly
yeah.
when he wrote things, because when he wrote things does not always correspond to when they were published. So
yeah, that's what I meant, though, like published works, the ones that the audience yeah. were able to read. This was at least within the first 10. Okay, so
yeah.
I think this is probably one of the earlier ones. I know this was like the first time Castle Rock was mentioned in a lot of his books, like take place either around or in Castle Rock itself. But
yes.
This was like one of the ones where he actually references one of his own books. Like, he's very self-aware and very meta and in a very like cheeky way, in a way that I think is very popular in media now. But
yeah.
Carrie was actually like the book Carrie was actually referenced within this book. And I love that. Like, I just thought that was like really funny. But then there was that moment at the end where like all those kids die at that graduation party at the bar, you know, like basically like the bar catches on fire and a bunch of high schoolers die. Like, It's a little Carrie, isn't it? Like, I was thinking, it's not a completely original idea, but it's effective.
Right.
Like, it does move the story forward in like a way, and it has a lot of stakes as they're like leading up to this like big sad moment.
She's not the only one that sort of pops up again throughout. Especially in this book, there are two characters who are either mentioned later or actually appear in later stories, and that's Sheriff Bannerman. And Frank Dodd is mentioned on more than one occasion, and he's the murderer you mentioned earlier, and he is creepy, to say the least. I think that's putting it mildly.
Yeah, and... but Frank Dodd is never in this book. Like, the killer is. Like, we meet the killer, but we never at any point meet a living Frank Dodd. Like, we never know the Frank Dodd that's you know, known around the town and is a, you know, a trusted police officer.
Yeah, he's sort of this ghost, kind of, in the story. You know, eventually we know that it is Frank Dodd, and he's mentioned later in Cujo, because they make a comment about how he terrorized Castle Rock in the late 70s or something to that effect. And then you're like, oh, okay, you know, I know exactly who they're talking about. And he is just so repulsive. Even if we only know him as the killer in this, it's one of those things. That's why I was like, oh, you read this in middle school? Are you sure?
Yeah, positive. Yeah. Yeah. I was reading fairly serious stuff early on. Like, I don't know how you would how some people would classify the Lord of the Rings, but I was reading the Lord of the Rings in second, third grade. I was reading stuff that probably wasn't necessarily right for my age group, but I was reading at a far enough level that I needed something longer, and those were like the longest books that my parents owned. So that's what I was reading.
Well, clearly if you didn't remember too much of it, it didn't completely traumatize you, so that's always a plus.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. You know, I read something on The Guardian the other day when I was preparing for this, and there was they did like a rereading Stephen King series a few years back. And the introduction to their rereading The Dead Zone was fascinating, because it was exactly my experience. The writer James Smith said, "The Dead Zone was the strangest experience of my rereading experiment thus far. It's the first book that is totally different to my memories of it, to the point where I even doubted that I had read it and hadn't just watched the admittedly excellent David Cronenberg movie adaptation too much. I had read it, though. I still have the original copy to prove it, but it had slipped from my mind almost completely. Into The Dead Zone?" Like, when I read that, I'm like, is it something about this book? Because, like, I know I've read this. I know I own it, but I haven't absorbed anything from this at all. And I have a fairly good memory for the stuff that I read, but it was really strange. I just remember, like, Frank Dodd, you know, dead in his upstairs bathroom. I remember that, you know, probably the most traumatic part of that whole book. And then I remember the first bit where he falls on the ice, and he like knows that the guy is going to have the battery explode in his face or whatever. But yeah, it's strange. I don't know. It's a weird experience, but I did enjoy it. And I'm trying to think, like, when I did read this, like, since I don't recall the book, I can't really speak too much for my younger self. But at that point in my life, I didn't really know a lot about the world. I definitely didn't know anything about politics, and that's changed a lot in you know, in the years since seventh grade, I guess. But in this book, I'd say probably the most important storyline, the most important thread, is the Greg Stilson line.
Yes.
And And I don't know if that's just because of the current climate, because there, you know, there are so many obvious parallels with Greg Stilson and Donald Trump and all of that. And Stephen King has talked about this already. Like, it's not a new thought. Like, he said, like, it's, you know, yes, there are similarities, but Donald Trump is not the first demagogue in American politics. Like, obviously, Greg Stilson was probably based on a real person or real people in American politics at the time. And, you know, they weren't the last, and they weren't, you know, there have been many since Donald Trump. Donald Trump is more prevalent because he rose to the level of United States president. But it's interesting to think about this book and draw those parallels and see, you know, there are moments where it's like, yeah, that's very like Trump-like. There are things that are very not Trump-like. Like, you know, this Gregory Stilson seems to have a very direct plan, whereas Donald Trump doesn't. So like, there are differences, there are similarities. But what I was thinking about most when I finished this book was, as a kid reading this, I wouldn't have thought that the Gregory Stilson bit was very interesting at all. Like, right. I don't care about politics. I wouldn't know the difference. Like, as a kid, I probably thought, oh yeah, you know, like, politicians are crooks or whatever. But I had no real concept beyond the founding fathers and all that you learn in history class. So to read about this guy back then wouldn't have really elicited much of a response from me, I don't think. I think that my former understanding of Johnny at the end had to have been completely different. Like, now I can kind of sympathize with him. Right. I might not, like, agree with the character and his decisions, like deciding to assassinate a politician based on what he knows and the feelings that he has towards him. I don't, like, agree with that, but I can understand the desperation that he has because he knows what's coming. Like, in today's climate, people reading this book are probably going to feel the same way, depending on where they fall on the party line. Because if they feel very strongly about Donald Trump one way, they're probably going to feel very strongly about this character in the same way. So I think when I was younger, I must have understood Johnny as, like, crazy. I would have thought that he was just mad because of his, you know, condition and the emotional trauma that he went through because of, you know, the accident and losing Sarah and, you know, all of the events that followed because of his ability. I think he would have just been crazy. But now, like, reading this now, I feel completely differently about it. And so that's kind of a neat thing, just to try to pop back into my old self and think, like, okay, seventh grade Jake, you know, you really don't know anything. What would you like? How do you finish this book? What are your thoughts about the main character at the end of the book? You know, going back on everything that, you know, you thought that he believed in regards to life and what's right and wrong and all that. But now, like, I can sense that desperation that he had, and it's a very, very, very interesting idea, very interesting concept to read post 2016.
You really get the sense that he is trying to do this for the greater good too, because of what he sees. So, you know, his power is being a clairvoyant. Basically, he can see what's coming when he touches objects or people, and when he shakes Stilson's hand, he sees this huge nuclear conflict that's going to arise. And it's not just a United States problem, it's a worldwide problem. So you definitely get more of the logic, I think, reading this at, you know, a later stage in your life. Because like you said, when you're in middle school, I don't think any middle school kid really has quite the universal perspective on how the world works, so to speak. And
yeah, they don't understand the stakes of anything. Like, a middle school doesn't well, I don't want to be reductive, because there are some middle schoolers out there that are probably, like, more informed on certain things than I am as an adult. But back then, I was definitely not one of those kids.
You know, like, I definitely mean more so back then. I think with this being part of the information age still and having easier access to the internet, obviously there's a lot more that middle school kids can more easily find out if they have access to those things. And
yeah,
you know, when we were kids, we probably weren't sitting in front of a computer quite as much when we were in elementary school and middle school, it's like we had them, but it wasn't something that was like an all-day event like it seems to be these days, where you're reading articles, recording podcasts, and doing all these things that we do in front of a computer screen. You know, I remember going outside and playing basketball in the driveway for like 2 hours a day or something ridiculous. You know, it's crazy how things have changed.
Oh, weren't you a good kid? I was the kid that got volunteered to teach other kids how to use word processors in third grade, like during recess. Like everybody would go outside. This other kid, you know, wanted to write this essay or something. I had to teach them how to use Microsoft Word. I was fixing computers for my teachers in elementary school.
That somehow does not surprise me at all.
No. I need to find it. I have the file somewhere, but I recorded my first ever podcast when I was in seventh grade, around the same time I would have read this book. That was when I recorded my first podcast. I don't know if they were,
without knowing what a podcast was or the fact that they actually existed.
No, they definitely, I mean, this was like podcasts really, they came into the iTunes, like the directory in iTunes came around in 2005. So it would have probably been in like 2006, 2007. I was fairly hip as a kid, and I did read the news. Like I found it. I found it a little newspaper of sorts, like a world newspaper in 2001, following the 9/11 attacks. That really kind of like opened my eyes to a bigger world in a way. And I had like a couple of kids, and like whenever we would have like an indoor recess because it was, you know, raining really hard or storming or something like that, we'd be inside. And so somehow I became like the head of this little newsroom, and I just kind of gave everybody assignments, and I was like, okay, your assignment is to basically write like a half page of facts about this Middle Eastern country, and then we would present those like papers to the class so we could teach the class about like the cultures and like the goings on in all these different countries and stuff. So I guess I was fairly hip, but I didn't really understand politics. Like I wouldn't have really understood any of that. I was a weird kid. You know, I read a lot of books, and for some reason I thought that that writing one pages on Kazakhstan was really important. But
that's too funny. Yeah, reading sort of became a lot bigger for me when I wasn't forced to do it. You know, I did not like reading in high school. I was just like, I don't want to read Jane Eyre or whatever. You know, I don't think I ever finished Crime and Punishment. It was assigned. I don't think I ever finished it.
Yeah, assigned reading was never fun. But
yeah,
I don't, did you have this out there? Did you have AR, Accelerated Reader?
I don't recall. I went to a really nerdy high school, so I think they just had us reading a lot anyway.
Okay.
But I don't recall.
But like in elementary school,
in,
you didn't?
Oh, I went to like weird Montessori private schools, not normal schools.
Cool.
So
no, that's really interesting. I want to learn more about that. Like we have one here in town, and it sounds interesting. It sounds like I actually might have done really well at a school like that. But
I definitely can answer any questions you have on that if you want to ask those after. We don't need a tangent on the podcast about that.
yeah maybe someday down the line, if I ever have a kid, I'll come to you and ask some questions. But yeah, no, in my public school, we had this program called Accelerated Reader, and it was like this computer program. You know, other schools had it too, and and basically, like, there was this list of books in this database in this computer program, and you could get these books from your school library, and there would be like a little, you know, blue AR sticker that would be on the spine, so you knew that it counted. Or you could go get the books from the public library, and you would read the book. And then you would take like a 10-question quiz about the book on Accelerated Reader. So, you know, you could do as much as you wanted. You just, the only limitation was how many books can you read? And I read a lot of books. I think I've told this story on another podcast, probably Podcasm, but I read, I think in my third grade year, I read more than the rest of my class combined. Or at least maybe not read as that much, but I had enough points that I was like twice everybody else combined. It was insane. And then the prize, like at the end of the semester, for anybody that had so many points, you know, there are different like prize tiers, and the biggest prize was that you got to take a limo ride out to like Burger King or something. And
so you were a hot shot because you read so much, is that what you're saying?
that's what I'm saying, except that I got chicken pox and I couldn't go.
Oh.
So
oh, no.
I'm
so
like
sad.
The star reader, and I couldn't go because I got chicken pox from Devin Lowe. Damn it, Devin. But yeah, that was a bummer. I did get to go the next year, except, and you know what? I did tell the story on Podcasm, so I'm sorry. Not that any of your listeners listen to that show.
I'm sure a few
this
do.
Is a spoiler for an episode that probably hasn't come out yet. But the second year I did get to go, but for some reason I made the decision to sit in the front of the limo with the driver because there wasn't enough seats in the back. And like it was just a question, like anybody could volunteer, and then, you know, if nobody did, then like somebody would have just had to, you know, get put up there. But I volunteered. And I don't know why, like I've still never ridden in the back of a limo. Like I've been in a limo, but I sat in the front with the damn driver. And the only thing that I got out of that was that I got to like choose what was on the radio. But nobody in the back seat cares about what's on the radio. They're all like having fun in a limo. I'm just like sitting up here in the front seat with this limo driver who's just like, God, I'm like sitting here awkwardly with this child, like who apparently reads a lot of books. Like how fun. So yeah, that's my fun accelerated reader story. But yeah, the Dead Zone was not on the accelerated reader program. That was a couple of years later.
I would hope not. If you were in like, you know, fourth or fifth grade reading that, mm-hmm. it might raise some questions.
I actually have some questions since you know a little bit more about the what do they call it, the Kingiverse, the Castle Rock universe. What do they call it?
I don't really know. I just call it the Stephen King universe because I don't know if it has a name. Maybe I should find out since I'm doing this podcast.
Or you could invent it. I mean, if there's nothing there yet, you can invent something. Let's just say the Kingiverse. So in the Kingiverse, a lot of stuff takes place in Castle Rock, and there are tie-ins like to other characters in this book. Do you know of any other like direct tie-ins with the story? Like, I know that there's no like Dead Zone sequel, so to speak, but is there anything that like really furthers the story or mentions Johnny or anything later on?
I think the ending left it a little open-ended there because I have been focusing a lot on the endings because a lot of people are very hit or miss with enjoying Stephen King's endings. But here, you know, just to quickly give some context, you have Sarah visiting Johnny's grave, and she was the girlfriend who went to the county fair with him, and then that's when the car accident happened and he ended up in a coma. So after Johnny dies, he is visited by Sarah at his grave, and there's a psychic connection there, and she sort of just leaves after that. So it kind of leaves it open to bring something back from the story, but as far as I know, there isn't anything just yet. You know, George Bannerman is someone who kind of sticks around because he's the sheriff of the town, so
right, yeah, he's, you know, involved, of course.
Yeah, and like I said, Frank Dodd has a mention later, but I wouldn't put it past him to still figure something out for this, because there were 40 years or so between The Shining and its sequel. So, you know, I would never put anything past Stephen King at this point. And I don't know if maybe the story was expanded on in the TV series because it ran so long. I can't imagine the story in this book alone would give you 5 seasons of a TV show.
Yeah, I'd assume that they would add a couple of psychic incidents that didn't necessarily happen in the book. Like, I think that they would probably follow the same thread because it is an interesting story, and it would be well adapted to the screen, I think, but they would have to add like a couple more episodes, unless it was like a very short one season BBC series or something like that. But
yeah, there are a few other connections. Apparently his grave is next to a couple other characters that have been in the universe. Let's see, you have Bowden from Apt People, and you have Marston from Salem's Lot. So he's buried next to those two men, and it is definitely interesting to find that out. I actually did not know that until I opened the Stephen King Wikia page here, so, you know,
interesting
learning things as we podcast here.
Yeah, that's cool. I like those tie-ins. I always like I like when things tie together and, you know, reward you for being a longtime fan, because it's not gonna, none of that's gonna matter to somebody who's just reading one book out of many Stephen King novels. But if you're a dedicated reader and you're rereading all of his stuff like you are, and James Smith was for The Guardian, like, you're gonna pick up on those things.
And he does do, like you said, a lot of the meta stuff where characters will be reading one of his own books in a later book or something like that, and I believe that happens with The Dead Zone as well. So
oh yeah, here it says that a robot butler named Nigel is reading The Dead Zone in the Dark Tower 7.
Yeah, I have not gotten that far yet, but that doesn't surprise me one bit.
He reviews his own book. In this book where this character is reading The Dead Zone, the character offers his own wholly impartial review of the book. Quite enjoyable, he says. That's good.
Yeah, so he does a lot of little things like that. Now I kind of want him to pick up with Sarah if they had this psychic connection at the end, because I wonder if he could do something where, you know, maybe a fraction of his powers get transferred to her or something. I don't know if that's possible, but it is fiction, so you can make it possible.
or they never, you know, they never say no to this in the book, but she did have a second kid after she saw him last.
Okay.
And, you know, there was that little tryst in the barn.
Yeah.
Johnny could have a kid.
With powers.
With powers.
So many possibilities now.
Is that the plot of The Shining sequel, though? I know nothing about it. I've heard about it. I know it's being adapted.
I haven't read it, but it follows Danny, who is the son in The Shining. Right. So it picks up with him 40 years later.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of on the same timeline as in real life when he wrote and released the books and everything like that. So it's definitely very interesting when he comes back to some of these characters, because it gives you a lot of time away. And with two adaptations of The Shining, you sort of get these two different takes on an adaptation of the book as well, which, you know, I guess Dr. Sleep will play out for people depending on if they've seen the adaptations and which they like better.
I'll be interested to see at least that movie. I don't know if I'll read the book, but I've never read The Shining. Obviously, I mentioned that I haven't read anything else by Stephen King yet, but I am interested in the story because the movie is great.
Yeah, the Kubrick one is quite different from the book, though, if you do get around to reading it.
Maybe I'll get the next James Franco audiobook.
I wouldn't say it's different bad, though. You know, obviously, the Kubrick's Shining is an amazing horror movie in general. It's just not what was in the book necessarily for some of it. And that is why I got some of that all mixed up when I was talking about the book. So, you know, had to do lots of editing in that episode. I was like, oh, those characters aren't in the book. Just kidding. But to bring it back to the ending here, was the ending something you enjoyed with having Sarah go visit him and then drive away in the epilogue and sort of just have this feeling of, okay, everything is fine now?
I don't know. I think that scene existed not necessarily for the benefit of the reader to, you know, establish any sort of idea of Sarah's relationship with Johnny towards the end of the book, but because I thought that was, you know, it benefited Johnny's character, but I didn't think it was like the most important part of the book. What I found most interesting about the end was more like the hearings. I think there were like hearings that were happening. There was like some committee that was investigating, you know, Stilson and the incident and how, you know, he basically used a child as a human shield when Johnny was firing at him with a gun, and like, you know, the fallout from that. I thought that was more interesting because that was Johnny's legacy. That's like what he died for, and the way that he chose to go. So, you know, it at least the ending let us know that Johnny was at peace, because obviously he was tormented by his powers and this impending, you know, nuclear holocaust that was going to be a result of Stilson winning the presidency down the line. And yeah, so that, I think it tied up nicely. Like the only thing that I kind of wonder about is, you know, like what the public perception of Johnny was, because like you said earlier, like the media played a really big part in Johnny's life after he had these powers, and he wasn't like a big fan of it, but you know, they always sort of like changed their minds on him. They would flip flop, you know, like first he's this like, you know, crazy shyster, and then, you know, he did this amazing thing, and then he scared this journalist, and then he saved these people, and then he's crazy again. Like they kept going back and forth on him. So knowing that, you know, he fulfilled his legacy, and like we know that everything turned out okay, and it seems like this committee has an understanding of what happened and why it happened, and there are people there to give legitimacy to Johnny's hysteria and what his rationale might have been and why. I don't know. I still would have liked it to have maybe got like a couple more news clippings like they did towards the end of the book. A lot of the stuff were just like little clippings from
letters and things like that.
I would have liked a couple more newspaper clippings about, you know, what the perception was of the public.
the clippings is something he'll sort of do in several of his books too, because I don't recall exactly how he worked it out in Carrie at this point, but you have the government involved in that because of the incident, and it's sort of similar to the media being involved in this. It's like, you know, they want things to go a certain way, so they're just going to give you the story that benefits what they want you to hear. And I think a few more of those would have been nice as well. It's just something that kind of adds to the story a little more and gives you a different perspective on it too, because you have different people writing these letters and articles and things like that.
Yeah, I like the format though, because it switches up the narration a bit. You know, you've right. got like, I think he writes most of his stuff in like third person, right? It's always, you know, Johnny does so and so and whatever.
Yeah, I think it varies depending on what kind of story he's telling. But yeah, okay. for the most part, I think when he's focusing on, you know, maybe fewer characters, I don't know. I haven't gotten to it yet, but because there are so many characters in that, it'll be interesting to see how he handles the storytelling in that.
I like changes of perspective, though, because it gives you a different frame for the context. Like,
right.
you know, the third person works in a lot of cases, and I think that's how I usually write my books, at least fiction. But when you switch it over and you're like, you're just reading these newspaper clippings, you can take things in from different people's perspective. Like it's different to hear a narrator tell you about what Johnny's dad thinks. It's a different thing to read a letter from his dad or to read a letter from Sarah. Like
yeah.
you're getting it straight from them, and it's a lot more affecting in that way.
It makes those characters more personable too, because for the most part, you know, this is about Johnny and what Johnny can do. So to then have those characters get to shine through these letters and everything, it's a chance for some character development that he might not have wanted to do from Johnny's perspective necessarily.
Yeah, I agree. I like it. I think the ending wasn't bad for me. I can see why maybe some people would be unsatisfied, but for me, I like when an ending leaves a little bit to be desired. I think it's more fulfilling in a way, because it allows me to continue to think about it. I don't necessarily think
right.
that everything needs to be all tied up.
I totally agree. And, you know, sometimes it's hard because you'll like how the book ends right before the epilogue, and then he goes and throws in an epilogue, and you're like, oh, I don't know if we needed this. And, you know, it's something that I've been enjoying discussing, because it's another thing where everyone's going to have a different opinion on endings specifically, because I feel like everyone wants you to nail the ending no matter what kind of media you're consuming. Maybe less so with, you know, listening to a podcast like this, because I would not venture to say I really nail endings on here. I just tell everyone to enjoy the rest of their day.
And that's the end of this episode.
Almost. Is there anything else you want to discuss here before we do wrap it up?
No, I mean, it was an enjoyable experience. Like, it was different. Like, when I was looking through the list of the stuff on your list, it would have been really easy for me to pick, I guess, literally anything else than this book, because I have very little knowledge of anything unless it's been made into a movie that I've seen. Like, obviously, I love the new It adaptation. I thought it's really great.
Yeah.
I like a lot of Stephen King stuff, and I like Stephen King. Like, I think he's a fascinating guy. I enjoy reading his writing about writing. I enjoy reading his tweets. I'm a fan of Stephen King. I'm not super involved in his work, but I did enjoy this, and I think it was an interesting way to kind of revisit an earlier version of myself based on this book that I had picked out from my parents' collection, and maybe why I would have read it and how I would have thought about it back then and how I think about it now. And I don't know, just kind of adds like this meta layer of enjoyment to the book that I don't think I would have gotten from anything else on the list.
Absolutely. And as you well know, there are still lots of openings on the list here, because this is a lengthy process, to say the least. And, you know, I'm trying to just plan this out as far in advance as I can. So, like I said, it can help not only me keep track of everything, but to give the guests time. It's like, okay, you know, I've started putting when these episodes are going to be posted. So if someone needs more time to read something, because, you know, like you, you're not a crazy reader like I am at the moment.
No, thank you for the extension, by the way. I appreciate that 1 week. It made a world of difference.
I didn't really feel bad skipping Thanksgiving week, so it's totally fine. I mean, I did feel a little bad because it was like, here's two episodes. Oh, we're taking a week off. But, you know, I don't think anyone cared.
Yeah. We were able to take the week off for the Podcasm podcast, but we still had an episode go up because we had like five advanced episodes to burn, and we needed to bring that down. So we did. Oh, and by the way, Mike and I were talking about the show on a fairly recent episode. I don't think it's out yet, but we were looking through this list just to see.
Oh, yeah.
Who
he
had
told
what.
Me.
I did add him to the list. He was waffling on. He's like, oh, man, Thinner's open. And I'm like, well, there you go. Not now. I put him down. And yeah, so Mike will be on the show at some point, too.
The more guests, the merrier for this podcast. Yeah. But yeah. That wraps it up. And like I said earlier, to all of our listeners, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks so much.